Chapter 35. Archive. Dark Knight 10 of year 3350. The heavy buckle of the tool belt closes with a loud click. The vacuum equipment dangles from a belt loop, ready to be used. Gronolf carries his weapon over his shoulder. He leaves his quarters without saying goodbye, just as if he were leaving for daily training, which is probably what his comrades are thinking. He walks slowly toward Sector 1. Mornaka has not contacted him again, and he already wonders when she will join him. Suddenly, she stands in front of him.
"What a coincidence," he says. "I've been waiting for you."
How did she know he would be coming this way? No matter, it was probably the most likely route. Gronolf gives her a friendly wink with his front eye, but she does not react to his gesture.
"Where do we have to go?" he asks.
"The security zone is in the hub connecting the drive and the living quarters." Near the sector borders, there are fold-out maps in the walls. Gronolf wants to open one of them to get an overview, but Mornaka stops him.
"I have an offline map here."
She shows him a roll about 1 foot long. Then she opens the map by rolling it out into a square. The map consists of a transparent material. It is not any thicker than his skin, but if you look at it from above, it seems to have great depth.
"A mobile hollow map?"
Gronolf asks. He can't help but shape his stomach fold into an expression of amazement. These maps are incredibly rare and expensive. Mornaka moves her hand across the edge of the map. The image zooms accordingly so that one can eventually see the entire majestic draft. The vessel is cube-shaped. The spherical drive sits in its interior like the kernel of a sea chestnut. From this drive, a kind of tube leads outward. To be more precise, a channel formed by magnetic fields. Around the drive, there is a structure several arm lengths thick, which surrounds it like a shell. The omniscience is located there. The area is completely inaccessible to the crew. If necessary, the omniscience will repair itself using special machines. The drive core cannot be repaired, as it is constantly in a fragile equilibrium, like an egg balancing on its tip. Only the omniscience is able to keep it in balance, and if it fails, the egg would burst, and the entire ship with it. It was partially for this reason the knowledge scientist gave the omniscience a certain degree of autonomy. The limiting factor, as smaller predecessor models had shown, was always the fact that the crew made wrong decisions. Gronolf's companion points at a tiny cube.
"This is the room we have to reach and secure," she says.
"And we can really deactivate the omniscience from there?"
"No, that is impossible. Then we could no longer control the drive system. However, we can sever the connection of the omniscience to the outside world."
"Then it will be alone with the drive core in eternal darkness."
"You said that very poetically, Gronolf."
He is not sure whether she is serious or whether she's making fun of him. Yet he does not show any reaction.
"Well, that is the case," he says. "If it receives no signals from the outside world, isn't it?"
Mornaka seems to ponder this. She moves her touch arms right and left.
"You're probably right."
"Then it won't be very happy about it."
"Certainly not."
"And what if it relinquishes control over the drive unit?"
"Then it would kill itself. That contradicts one of its basic rules. It is not allowed to harm itself."
Right now, Gronolf feels quite ignorant. Isn't Mornaka officially a learner, while he is the experienced officer?
"Let's go," he says.
Mornaka types something on the map and then rolls it up again. Then she pulls a kind of button from her belt pouch, moistens it with stomach acid, and sticks it on her skin at chest height. Gronolf recognizes that it is a sound button.
"This way the map can tell us where to go," Mornaka says.
"This way the map can tell you where to go," Gronolf thinks.
He starts to dislike this mission, because it looks as if he will have to follow an inexperienced learner no matter what happens. Yet he does not comment, because whoever awarded her the responsibility for the expensive map must have had certain reasons. He is obviously considered primarily as a protector watching Mornaka's back. His companion starts moving. Gronolf follows her. This way he can at least admire her from behind. Soon he is no longer familiar with the corridors they are traversing. Tunnels, doors, new tunnels, and then a large room, one following after the other. At first he tries to memorize the path, or at least keep an image in his mind, but after 10 turns he no longer stands a chance. They are making good progress, until they encounter the first locked door. Mornaka looks at the map, which insists that the door should be open.
"There's no other way," she says.
"Good. At least that's a change,"
Ranulf replies. He takes his weapon off his shoulder. He can quickly blast through the door.
Perhaps it would be enough to cut through the lock, Marnaka says, offering him a small welding gun from her tool belt.
Ranulf is disappointed, but refuses to show it. The harpoon will have its chance. He aims the welding gun at a point near the door lock and moves it in a circle around it. When he is about halfway finished, he notices a breeze. A bulkhead slams down behind them.
Vacuum mask, he warns her,
takes his mask off his belt and puts it on. Ranulf does the same. Shortly afterward, he manages to kick in the door. He has to hold on so that the air pressure won't suck him inside. The room behind the door is large and empty. There are bunks along the walls. This might have been a sleeping area once. One can only survive here with a mask. His companion consults the map, but she doesn't say anything. He follows her through two more doors. They've arrived in a room that must have been a kitchen. Cooking utensils are neatly arranged on a shelf. The stove looks freshly cleaned. Marnaka suddenly stops. He can barely avoid bumping into her from behind.
What's up? He asks.
Then he realizes Marnaka cannot hear him due to the vacuum. Her right touch arm points downward. Ranulf steps aside and sees what his companion tried to avoid. A Grosnop is lying on the ground. The male is holding a cutting tool in his hand. He must have been surprised by the pressure loss during his work.
Another one of these accidents, Ranulf thinks. How many of my comrades have been killed by the omniscience so far?
Marnaka hits the top of the table so hard that a dent appears in the middle, but he hears no sound. She raises her arm again, but he grabs it. If she keeps hitting the table, she might injure herself. She looks at him. He notices the anger in her front eye, its lid trembling. Yet she obviously is trying to suppress this emotion and replace it with something he interprets as gratitude. Ranulf is glad that he is unable to say anything right now. Marnaka points at a narrow door to the left. It won't open. The air pressure behind it probably is still normal. Now they have to be careful. If they simply open the lock, the vacuum will spread to the neighboring room, and they would help the omniscience in depopulating the ship. Ranulf turns around. The kitchen is not very large. He closes the door behind them and welds it shut for safety's sake. Then he starts opening the door in front of them. Another bulkhead slams down in the distance. He notices it by the vibrations of the floor. The automatic system has noticed the loss in pressure. The kitchen is gradually filling with air. Ranulf watches his vacuum mask's display. Soon he will be able to breathe normally again. Once the area is safe, it should be possible to open the bulkhead further ahead. Marnaka touches his hand and points at the dead male.
We have to leave him here, he says. Otherwise the omniscience will notice that we are advancing.
Don't you think it noticed us cutting doors open? It already knows we're coming.
She's right. He picks up the corpse with all four of his arms. Due to the time spent in the vacuum, it has become very light. Marnaka steps aside so he can carry the dead into the adjacent room. There he discovers a bed. He places the corpse on the sleeping beam. One might think he simply fell asleep peacefully.
Control room, we found a corpse. Please pick up in...
Marnaka looks at the map.
Sector 332.
Confirmed. Ranulf looks at his companion. She shows no signs of weakness. Nevertheless, he feels it is his duty to ask,
should we take a break?
Are you tired?
She asks him.
I'm not.
Then let's go on.
He waits for her to get moving. Marnaka closes her right eye. She seems to be concentrating on what the sound button on her skin tells her. Then she walks away with rapid steps. Ranulf has to hurry so he won't fall behind. She is really well trained and in shape. Obviously, the learners have not grown soft. He could not chase his recruits through the corridors at this speed. However, Marnaka has longer legs because she is a female, so it is a bit easier for her. The halls and rooms they enter and leave seem deserted, though sometimes they encounter a technician or a soldier standing guard. The leadership has not given up the plan to keep the sectors habitable. The map either leads them around airless zones, or those particular zones are becoming rarer the closer they get to the center. This allows them to proceed swiftly. Ranulf allows himself some thoughts that have nothing to do with the room in front of him.
What will the new world be like?
The space scientist calculated that it should be habitable and offer water. It is for that reason his people risked everything and built the majestic draft as a colony ship. Old texts contain hints about a world with only one sun. Gronlof loved these stories as a child, but he was always aware these were only fairy tales. Now the fairy tales are coming true. Mornaka slows down after a while. Is she finally getting tired? Wonders Gronlof. He winks at her, but she doesn't react this time either. Instead, she places her load hands on the pit of her stomach. This is a warning sign. What is she warning him about? Mornaka comes closer, so close that her typically feminine scent enters his smell sensors. Gronlof would like to take a step back, but how would she interpret that? The sector in front of us is secret, she whispers. So secret, I did not even know about it until now. What is going on here? He adjusts his voice level to hers. My father described this to me before the launch. The leadership group has developed an alternative program to compensate for the accidents. How would this work? Gronlof asks the question, but he already has an idea of what the answer will be, and he doesn't like it at all. Just like in the double sun system, females lay eggs, males fertilize them. He does not want to hear that. If it is true, it would represent an enormous breach of taboo. Eggs are only allowed to be laid by certain females on certain days, in the sand of an ocean beach. Any child knows that this rule serves to protect the double sun system against overpopulation. In ancient times, it was different, but in a modern society, too many descendants in a plex survive. They are not allowed to, Gronlof says. I now understand why. He stops in mid-sentence. Why what? The leadership abandons our traditions in order not to endanger our cooperation with the omniscience, he says. There is no other way. You really think so, Mornaka? Who are we to break with the traditions of our fathers? Space travelers. We are space travelers. So when we arrive at single sun, we will be different from what we were at launch. Yes, Gronlof. Every day will change you and me. We will never again be what we are today. Oh, certainly not. Gronlof can't quite follow her argument. Giving up ancient traditions for a short-term advantage? It seems wrong to him. Yet it would be useless to reproach her. After all, she has to obey her father, just as he must obey his. I'm just asking you, Gronlof, to behave inconspicuously while we traverse this sector. Stay calm no matter what you see. Will you promise?
I am calmness personified.
The entrance to the area is blocked by a yellow double door. Mornaka enters her authentication code at the lock sensor. The system does not reply. He can see she's getting nervous, as her eyelids are trembling. So maybe she is not as cool and collected as she pretends to be. Mornaka repeats her code, but nothing happens this time either. Is there a way around this zone? Gronlof asks. She opens the map and studies the planned route. Unfortunately, no, she says. We can't go around it. Then we have to break the door open. Well, we already have experience with that. No, wait. Let us first check whether there is another entrance.
That is a good idea, Gronlof, Mornaka says, as she consults the map.
There are two additional entrances to this area we can try. Her arms fall down limply, indicating her relief. They start moving in single file. They reach the first door relatively quickly. It is narrow and green, and looks more like an emergency exit. Mornaka identifies herself at the sensor, but the door remains closed. Gronlof starts getting nervous while they are looking for the third entrance. It is not easy to find, and it finally turns out to be hidden behind cabinets. After he has moved those aside, his companion slowly approaches the wireless door lock. He can clearly see she is afraid, and her fear affects him, even though he's not sure what he's afraid of. Does Mornaka know something of which he is unaware? Finally, she pulls herself together and transmits her access data. Nothing happens, which is what he feared. Mornaka turns around helplessly.
We will now go back to the main entrance and open it by force, Gronlof says. The risk of damaging something is much smaller there.
Mornaka does not react, so he walks ahead. Through his rear eye, he sees her following him.
Is there something I need to know? He asks quietly.
No, it's only a hunch, but it scares me.
So she admits being afraid. That is a real sign of trust, he thinks. Then I hope there is no reason for your fear, and if there is one, I am prepared for it. Nobody will get past me.
He points at the weapon he carries over his shoulder.
Not all problems can be solved by... Sorry, Gronlof. I am grateful you are trying to protect me.
While Granoff doesn't know why she should thank him for something that goes without saying, her words make him feel warm inside. Ranaka's hunch is verified by a breeze. He feels it on the hand holding the blowtorch, and he sees it by the changing form and color of the flame. Behind the door, which is supposed to contain a hidden nursery school, there must be a vacuum. He turns off the blowtorch.
"Why did you stop?" asks Ranaka.
"There's something wrong here," he says.
"Then we have to get in there even quicker."
"That probably isn't a good idea."
Yet Granoff suppresses the thought because he is afraid of the images they might be confronted with. Nevertheless, he reaches for the vacuum mask, as does Ranaka. Then he removes the door lock and waits for the pressure to equalize.
"The room behind the door cannot be very large because the pressure equalized quickly," he says.
His voice sounds quieter and higher pitched because the air pressure is reduced.
"Good, then the occupants might have retreated into adjacent rooms."
He opens the door. The lighting integrated into the walls comes on as they enter the room, which is almost empty. There are only a few devices near a wall, but he cannot guess at their functions.
"We have to go there,"
Ranaka says, pointing to a door on the right side of the room. She tries to use her access data, but this lock also does not react. Granoff did not expect anything different and already has the blowtorch ready. Once again, he feels the telltale breeze as soon as the flame has cut through the material.
"Vacuum," he says. "But that makes no sense. The rooms are sealed off and airtight.
Somebody must have pumped out the air via the life support system."
Granoff only knows one entity that could have done that. He cautiously opens the door. This looks like a conference room. The furniture has been thrown around as if the occupants were defending themselves against something. There are two black lines on a wall. Granoff examines them. They are dried out.
"Could be blood," he says, "or possibly some kind of paint. Do we have a molecular analyzer?"
"No."
The room has only one exit. Close to it, he finds a part of a machine that looks like a support arm. It is heavy and made of metal. He examines it from all sides.
"Look at the fracture surface here."
He holds the thing closer to Ranaka.
"This must have involved considerable forces."
"But where is the rest of the machine?" she asks.
"Perhaps behind this door," he replies.
At first, it feels like it always does when he tries to use force to open the door. The typical breeze tells him the air pressure behind it is even lower. They wait for the pressure to equalize. However, even after he removes the lock, the door cannot be opened. He bends down and looks through the hole with his front eye. The room behind it is dark, so he takes a lamp from his tool belt and shines it inside. Another chaotic scene.
"They must have welded the door shut on all sides," he says. "But we'll fix that in a moment."
He looks at Ranaka, but she does not resist when he takes his weapon off his shoulder. He aims at the left hinge and triggers the harpoon. The shot is not as loud as he expected. The door falls forward. This movement automatically activates the room lighting and gives him a free field of view.
"Back there," Granoff calls out.
He has to yell so that Ranaka can still hear him, because the air is so thin by now. A shapeless mass is lying in the left corner. Ranaka runs forward. He deliberately takes his time so he will be prepared for what he sees. His companion holds her touch arms in front of her front eye. Her eyelids are trembling. In front of them is a Grossknob, definitely a female. Three of her forearms are interlaced in an unnatural way. The fourth one has been severed, and someone stuck it into her breathing fold. She probably suffocated from it, unless the vacuum killed her first.
"Who would do something like that?"
He realizes that Ranaka knows the answer. No Grossknob would mutilate another one like this. There were wars in the history of his people in which countless plexes died, but according to the historians, they always kept to the rules of warfare. This one seems to be still fresh, unlike the first corpse they found. The vacuum has hardly dried out the corpse, so she cannot have been here much longer than 2 days.
"We have to concentrate," Granoff says. "The enemy might be still nearby."
However, that is not very probable. The omniscience could not have known they were coming. Why should it have its machines waiting here? Yet they have to be careful. Who knows what kind of strategies the omniscience might develop?
"What should we do about her?"
Ranaka asks, then turns around and looks at him with her front eye.
"We can't do anything.
The control room?
I don't think it would be a good idea if they sent someone here."
"You're right, Granoff. Nevertheless, it feels wrong to leave her here in such a state."
We can pick her up on the way back.
If we ever return, Gronov thinks. The omniscience seems to be a merciless opponent. He has no clue how they can fight it. The room has three doors, and all of them have been welded shut from the inside.
Gronov finds the blowtorch the woman used and hooks it into his tool belt. How did the murderer make it into this room, though?
He looks at the ceiling. There are two life support vents there. The machine that killed the female must have come via the air ducts. Why didn't he notice this earlier? He points upward.
Could we advance faster in there?
Ronak unrolls the map and zooms in on the duct layer between this level and the next.
The pipes are very narrow. Do you really want to risk it?
Tactically, this is more of a disadvantage. He would either have to crawl with his weapon at the ready, which would slow him down, or he would have to drag it behind, making himself vulnerable. He definitely won't be able to react quickly to attacks coming from behind. It all depends on whether the omniscience is expecting them by now. They probably have to assume this to be the case.
We're staying down here, he says. That way we are prepared for any surprise. But we also have to keep the ducts in view, both in the ceiling and in the floor.
Fine. We have to continue through this door.
His companion points to the right.
Gronov takes the weapon from his shoulder when he remembers they should first check what lies behind it.
He melts a peephole into the metal and takes a look. The room is cluttered and airless. He places a small explosive charge into the harpoon, aims, and pulls the trigger. The explosion blows the door out of its frame. As before, the light is activated, but this time Gronov also sees something move on the floor. Something is quickly slithering toward them. He has no time to replace the explosive charge, but even without it, the harpoon is a destructive weapon. He aims the barrel down slightly, calculates the enemy's movement, and fires. The harpoon hits the ground three leg lengths away from him and gets stuck. Dust is stirred up, which settles only slowly.
Watch out!
Gronov yells, holding back Monaka, who is trying to run ahead. He slowly approaches the spot where the harpoon is stuck in the ground. Something is wriggling around it. A hit! The hardened arrow has pierced the middle of a long, slender machine and pinned it to the ground. It is made of a dark material, certainly not steel, probably carbon fibers, and it is divided into many small segments that can be twisted. It reminds Gronov of a swamp crawler, a specialty of the Coal Coast, which is often eaten grilled. What could be the function of this machine? Is it a spy? Or does it also possess weapons? Could it kill a Grosnop? He notices how its segments are twisting more and more. The rear of the machine is hardly moving, but the front obviously does not want to accept being pinned by the harpoon. If the segments twist any further, the whole thing is going to rip itself apart.
That is probably its intention, Gronov thinks.
And at that moment, the front part of the fake swamp crawler tears itself free. It is so fast that it zooms away between Gronov's feet. In the same moment, he sees through his rear eye how Monaka raises her right load hand and hits the fleeing remainder of the machine.
Got it,
she calls loudly, raising her hand. Hitting the hard floor must have been painful for her, but she does not let it show. The swamp crawler lying on the floor now is only half as high and no longer moves. No matter what it was, a harmless spy or the murderer of the female in this room, Gronov cannot suppress a shout of joy, and Monaka joins him. They have rested for half a bubble period. All by themselves, and without talking about it, they slid to the floor with their backs to the wall, stretching out their legs. A conversation would have been too exhausting due to the masks and the thin air, but Gronov was in no mood for talking anyway. He doesn't often feel like this, but it happens with Monaka. He can simply sit without saying anything, and it doesn't feel awkward. He is gradually starting to feel hungry. Therefore, he pulls some dried food out of his belt pouch, giving Monaka half of it. Then they drink water from a dispenser in the wall. He's still not saying anything, but both of them seem to feel that the time for leaving has come. Monaka pulls out the map and then points forward with her touch arm. He looks at the path ahead of them. There's still a long way to go. They will be traveling for several days if they have to continue opening doors by force. Yet he doesn't mind. He's actually glad, because the time with Monaka seems more valuable to him than any minutes without her. He doesn't know what is wrong. He keeps catching himself watching her flawless green skin and admiring the play of the muscles in her powerful thighs. He must not get distracted by this. Before they open the next door, Gronov first seals the door behind them.
because Murnaka has discovered a control panel for the life support system. Using it, she can purposely re-establish normal air pressure. The omniscience is not overriding it. Murnaka sets the life support to keep the pressure on a normal level. Now they can finally take off the masks and talk normally. They reach the next two rooms via the proven blowtorch method. Gronulf wants to open the third door this way, but then the sensor reacts and asks for authorization. His companion enters the data, and the two of them are admitted. Are they past the worst parts of this sector now? Gronulf would like to believe that, but then where are the occupants, particularly the children who were supposedly raised here? The room they are entering looks as if it had just been left. There are scattered documents, and a monitor displays the data of an experiment. On a table, Gronulf finds an open food container, which still smells fresh. In the corner is a climbing plant just starting to blossom. He admires the cyan blue of its leaves. Plants are not allowed in the crew quarters. Gronulf has the impression of detecting the various scents of numerous comrades in the air. Males and females seem to have worked together in this room. Yet where have they gone? And why? In the middle of the large room, there are wide double doors on both sides. Murnaka points left. That way, she says. The doors are not locked, and Gronulf can push them open by hand. He takes his weapon off his shoulder, but he detects no danger. This area is covered in waterproof tiles. It could be a hygiene room. After all, the crew has to wash somewhere. Along the walls, Gronulf sees long basins with side walls at chest height, so he cannot discover what is in them. Above the basins, heat lamps were later added, which is unusual. No, this is not a normal hygiene room, unless the crew of this sector has grown totally soft. Gronulf approaches one of the basins and looks over the edge. He jerks back immediately. He has to get this image out of his head, as otherwise he will go insane. He grabs hold of Murnaka, who also wants to peek into the basin. Don't, he says. He is unable to utter more. Murnaka wiggles out of his grip. Normally he would be strong enough to hold her, but right now he has to empty his stomach. The fold opens, and all the food squirts out. He has entered a nightmare. How can he get out of it again? Gronulf pinches his thigh, but he is still caught in this false reality. Through his rear eye, he sees Murnaka holding onto the side of the basin. Despite this, she is swaying heavily, as if a heavy tremor hit the ship. Oddly enough, this scene gives him new energy. He has to protect Murnaka and keep her from perishing due to the sight. Gronulf takes three rapid steps and jerks her toward him so violently that she falls on her back. Murnaka utters a painful shriek. Gronulf briefly peers into the basin, briefly, yet much too long, because he will never escape the sight of extremely decomposed children immersed in a slimy, stinking sludge. They will never experience their draft. He feels like he's being welded to the side of the basin, like being unable to ever avert his front eye. Yet then Murnaka's fall pulls him involuntarily away, and he also lands on his back on the cold tile floor, breathing heavily. For half a bubble period, they just lie there. They don't say a word, and they don't move, because each of them is busy trying to purge the horrible images, so there will be space for other thoughts in their minds. Then Gronulf slowly gets on his feet again, carefully avoiding a look over the edge of the basin. He's still swaying a bit, but he stands on two legs. Somehow he has the feeling he should take the weapon off his shoulder. He slowly walks to the exit. Where are you going? To the other two doors. Murnaka briefly moves arms and legs, but she still remains on the floor. Let her rest. He has one more task to fulfill. Gronulf goes through the double door and back into the large room. He traverses it and reaches the other double door. It is slightly ajar, and he sees a narrow gap between the two doors. He only has to push it open with his hand, but something is holding him back. It is the fear of what he might witness. He unlocks the safety catch on his weapon. This is foolish, but the weapon gives him strength. He uses its tip to push the right side of the door open and enters the room. It looks just like the other one, with tiles everywhere and basins at the edge and with heat lamps above. Yet there is a crucial difference he sees at once, which he simply can't ignore. The crew members, who had been missing in this sector so far, sit inside the basins. They are arranged in a neat sequence, and they don't move. A long row of big black eyes is staring at him. He can only see their upper bodies. They look uninjured, as if they might get up at any moment. but an unmistakable odor of blood emanates from them. Gronulf does not have to get any closer to be sure they are all dead. He turns around and leaves the room again. The door closes behind him with a squeak. Then he changes his mind. Everyone must know what happened here. He re-enters the room, takes a recording device from his belt, and starts filming. A few moments is all he needs, as the images have so much effect. Then he walks to the edge of the basins, holds the device over them without looking himself, and presses the record button again. When he is done, he feels an enormous sense of relief.
What are you doing there?
He steps next to Myrnaka and helps her get up.
Just a few recordings. You want to—
Yes. What happened here must not remain without witnesses.
Myrnaka places her right touch arm on his back.
We should not rush things.
Whoever is responsible must be punished.
And who is responsible for it?
The leadership group? Because it broke the taboo and allowed procreation, perhaps even experimented with it?
The omniscience will claim that it only interfered because rules have been ignored.
Myrnaka, you'd better take another look over the edge of the basin. Then maybe you wouldn't talk like that anymore.
Gronulf immediately realizes this is unfair. Myrnaka pulls her hand back and stiffens. Perhaps he can make amends? To be honest, she was just as shocked by these murders of innocents as he was. And he did not think that she was trying to protect the leadership or even the omniscience.
I'm sorry, he says, but we cannot simply pretend we never saw this. Something like this must never happen again. Somebody has to determine the cause and punish the guilty ones.
There is still time for that after we return. Otherwise, it will just be more of these bad decisions.
Perhaps she is right. Myrnaka is smart, and it is true that determining the culprit would be hard. Yet he feels he cannot finish his task unless he has at least done something about this matter. Everyone has to know what happened here.
I am sorry, he says, but I simply can't do what you say. The burden is too heavy. I can't just go on like this.
I understand, Myrnaka says.
As a sign of her grief, she has pulled all four eyelids slightly upward.
Then it simply has to be done. I'm not angry at you, even though I think it is the wrong decision.
That last sentence encourages him. He turns around and starts looking for a console. In the middle room, he finds a control panel. He attaches the recording device and starts the transmission. They traverse three more rooms. In the fourth, they find a resting area. The sleeping beams look so inviting that they almost simultaneously decide they really need a few hours of rest. They share a bit of dried food and wash up. Gronulf stretches along the length of his beam. Letting his limbs hang down feels good.
Quiet waters,
Myrnaka wishes him before falling asleep, following tradition.
Quiet waters, he replies.